Hello, Catherine here. If you're listening to my podcast because you're a fan of wintering, the good news is that my new book, Enchantment, is available now. It's a book about how we can find a way to reconnect with a world that's sometimes hard to live in and even to find magic there. It's available in all good bookshops and please support your local indie if you can. For more information, you can go to catherine-may.com/enchantment. Happy reading.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, I'm Catherine May, author of Wintering and Enchantment, and this is How We Live Now, a podcast that looks for pathways through this post-everything world. Each season, we ask a range of wise people a common question and roam around in the breadth and depth of our knowing. How We Live Now is made possible by my brilliant community at Substack. For newsletters, book clubs, live hangouts, and ad-free episodes of this podcast, go to catherinemay.substack.com. Good morning. It's 7:45. And I'm down here on the beach ready for a swim. It's a beautiful day. Not too hot. There's a few white clouds in the sky and a little breeze, which means that the sea has got a few waves on it. Sometimes in the summer like this, it's absolutely mill pond flat, but today it's got some bite about it. I'm looking forward to getting in. Hello, sea. You're lovely and clear. Before I get in, I need to tell you about this week's episode where I'm talking to Bayo Okomolafe, the fantastic public intellectual, speaker, writer, academic, thinker of some of the most challenging, exciting, contemporary thinking that we have right now. He was born in Nigeria. And since then has taught and worked and lived all over the world and is particularly influenced by his Indian wife. He spent a lot of time researching life in the Indian slums. And I wanted to talk to him for ages. I was so excited when he agreed to speak to me. And I knew that the conversation would never be a straightforward one. I wanted to meander with him. I wanted to get down deep into his thinking and to enter that really playful space where you can explore ideas amicably and in a way that is not combative, that's about chiming two voices together. I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. I took enormous pleasure in it and I've been thinking about the conversation ever since. But it is not full of simple ideas. Bio works in complexity and in turning the world upside down right before our eyes. There's magic everywhere in his thinking and in his writing. And I really wanted to draw some of that out today. Okay, that's enough. I'm getting in the sea now. I'll have a chat with you when I get out again. Bio, welcome to How We Live Now. It's such a privilege to have you here. I have been thinking for a long time about how I could get you onto the podcast because your book, These Worlds Beyond Our Fences, was just such a revelation to me in so many ways. But I don't want to talk about that specifically today because that's too easy. But I wanted to invite you on to share your incredible perspective on the world. So welcome.
It's a great pleasure to be here, sister, and to have this conversation with you. And I've been looking forward to this as well. So feeling is neutral.
It's a good way to spend an afternoon. Okay, well, let's just let everyone know who you are and where you come from, first of all. You've got a fascinating background. You come from, I'll let you tell it, you come from a Nigerian family, but you don't live in Nigeria anymore.
No, I was born in Nigeria, 3 months out from being born, obviously. I moved to Germany with my family. My father was a diplomat. And so we moved to Germany, which happens to be the place where I'm speaking to you from now. And we were a very itinerant family, traveling all over the place. But I did most of my growing up in Nigeria, schooling in Nigeria, teaching in Nigeria. And then I got married to a beautiful Indian, African Indian woman and moved to India. And that is where I have made my home.
Which links to your work as well, because I think you spent some time as an anthropologist researching Indian life in slums. Is that right?
I was trained as a psychologist. I don't think it would be improper for you to actually tag me with anthropology, because I've always been fascinated with cultures and anthropology, even having my own teaching colleagues say, you know, stick to the tried and true path of psychology and don't wander off the highway. But I never saw disciplinarity as a single monolithic enterprise. I always saw it as transversalized, as crisscrossing, as crossroadian, and as tricksterish. My adventures in studying and staying in slums or wanting to understand from different perspectives have always been transdisciplinary in that way. Yeah.
Well, it's funny because my first degree was transdisciplinary in social psychology, anthropology, and sociology. Oh, so I think I don't know the difference between the three of them, honestly.
Yeah. It's a way to go. It's the way to see the world. From my perspective, there is no easy Newtonian thing to arrive at. We live in a crossroads.
So how did you come to the point of writing? Did that emerge from a kind of academic impetus, or was it more about telling your life story? Because you're a beautiful memoirist, aren't you, I think.
Thank you so much. I'm blushing. You can't see it, but I'm blushing. I started to write at a very young age. I had elaborate plans to write encyclopedia.
I love that.
Which didn't make any sense whatsoever to my parents, but I just wanted to write. I remember as a freshman, no, I think I was a sophomore in the university, and I wanted to give a public lecture, you know, just because professors were doing it, so why not a student? And so they asked me to actually, let's have a student try to give a public lecture. So I wrote my lecture. It was very Christocentric, which described my religious persuasion at the time. And so I wrote a public lecture called Moses or Darwin, you know, how, I forget the tagline. It was something about creationism, you know.
Oh, wow.
Yes. And it became 200 pages. I wrote 200 pages.
That doesn't surprise me at all.
And so the university counseled it and persuaded me to make it a book. Yeah. Because I just felt So from a very early age, I've always felt this, what I might call an ecological ventriloquism, like something possesses and wants to write so that in a sense, I'm not the author.
Yeah, yeah. So that something else is speaking through you.
Yes. And I know that sounds corny sometimes, but it really feels like a very pressing and compelling felt experience that I'm not the one moving the pen. And I ritualize this in some ways by listening to music to write. And without that agency, writing becomes impossible for me.
That's so interesting. Yeah. And it's definitely my experience too, that I can't access the part of me that writes.
Yeah.
Like I don't know where that comes from. And I certainly have no control over it. I only wish I did.
Yes.
And it always feels like when I have written that I can look back over it and just wonder where those thoughts connected together. Like how, when did those connections happen and how?
Exactly.
It's mysterious.
Exactly. I have the same feeling. Yeah. Like, yeah, this is nice. Like I'm viewing it as if for the first time, which is reassuring.
Yeah. Well, every now and then I get asked to write something that I haven't, you know, that the spirit isn't moving me for. And that's so hard. And I wonder if that's how other people find writing. Like all these people that hated writing at school, I think that's how it must have been for them. No wonder they hated it. It's awful.
Yeah.
It's drudgery. Yes. So we are talking in this season about enchantment, which I've just written about. And my perspective on it was really that of a beginner and a learner to be more enchanted and to let that fluidity between the observable and the provable and the statable to other people flow with those edges of my perception that I can't give voice to and that are maybe not the same as other people's perception either. Mm. And I think for me, your work often speaks at the edges of that too, that you're thinking about that huge mixture of what it is to be human.
Right.
Does that make sense to you, first of all?
Yeah,
am I posing?
Yes, I mean, edges. Yeah. We are constantly performing edges, like to give ourselves definitions. Our stories are replete with edge ritualizing work, right? Like this is where the city stops and this is where the wilds begin. This is where what it means to be human. And the other side of that is the monster. So we're constantly making edges. This is the reason why I named my book, These Wilds Beyond Our Fences. It's like at some point we will need to lean on the fence long enough to break into the so-called disreputable wilds to meet the monsters that we've cordoned off or quarantined or pushed away. The ontology of where we are is hollowing out and it's pushing us and to the edges, right? So edges, right?
And I feel, I was writing about this morning actually, like I've always identified as an edge dweller. Mm-hmm. That's where I'm comfortable, on the borders between. And I think that's maybe where writers live in lots of ways. We're interpreters between those two places. We speak both languages.
Yes. Yes.
But I feel like this age is the age of the edge dweller. Like we're beginning to feel at home when everyone else is getting intensely uncomfortable.
Yeah, yeah. It's, I put it this way that, I've often written it this way that I think it was Karen Burrard that said that we are in a time when the world is kicking back. I like the idea of the world kicking back. Suddenly the world isn't this mute instrumental backdrop to human sociality. The world is also an actor on the stage, or the stage is an actor as well. And the stage is mounting up an insurgency against the plot, if you will. whether it's the hero's journey or whatever is playing out on the stage is like, I will have my say. And I think that's the very definition of enchantment for me. When things spill, when things refuse categorization or instrumentality.
Yeah. And in your hands, the world is sentient. I mean, there's not even a sense of animism that I read in you. There's a sense instead that we are interacting with another sentient system and indeed a part of a sentient system.
Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead, sister. Yeah.
No, I was going to turn it into a question, but actually it isn't really. It was just a provocation for you to talk.
I lean heavily on panentheistic, not pantheistic, but panentheistic, which of course is processual thinking and thinks about God or whatever you want to call it as becoming, right? Not as a grand, pure ontology of being, but as a becomingness, right? In the same way, I think, you know, there's a lot of talk these days about entanglement and how we are related with the world, especially in times of IPCC reports and doomsday clocks and pandemics and the Anthropocene. We are learning that we are entangled with the land. But I don't think that even goes far enough, because it suggests that we are this independent qualities, that we have independent edges and boundaries. Fait accompli. We're already made. And then we have relations with the world. No, I think the world, what we rudely and conveniently call the world, is a flow of relations. Somehow we concretize or we are crystallized from those ongoing relationships. So yes, this is sentience touching itself orgasmically, looking for itself. It informs my view, for instance, about AI and, and the hubris of believing that intelligence can be natural, right? In the ways that we presume it to be when we name clunky bits of metal artificial, and then we look to our flesh, organic and pink, and we call it natural. There's a sense in which the world is denaturing itself, that nature isn't some place, location in the distance, that nature is a constant denaturing of itself. It's a constant exploration of place and space and temporality.
I'm more and more troubled by this word nature and natural, because it... I don't know. I mean, I think if you're like a white female, you know, like a white female writer writing in the West and you write about human experience, you get called a nature writer at the moment. And so that's often pinned on me. And it comes with this set of assumptions about what I believe. And so quite often when I'm being interviewed, people will say, well, of course you think we should put our phones down and go out and walk in nature. And I'm like, I actually don't. I mean, I love walking, but I feel like I'm in nature everywhere. Yeah. I don't understand where the line is drawn and how other people see that line as being so definitive. But also I don't understand how that doesn't extend onto my phone, honestly, and into the environments that are created there and the contact I feel with other people on there. Yes. It just doesn't make any sense to me. It feels to me like such narrowed, boundaried thinking, and it's fundamentally punitive. Which is, it's just the spirit of how we talk about everything, but it punishes us for wanting to make connection in a world that feels so dislocated. And I don't see the problem with us seeking connection, really.
Oh, those are wise words. It's the sticky and resilient enlightenment thinking, right? It's nature is out there and we are in here. And then the involutions or the inflection points now say, oh no, we are connected to nature. And so we then see built environments as not nature, right? Which only reinforces the same thinking that led us to thinking about nature as outside in the first place, the patch of green in the distance. So seeing phones as nature might be shockingly offensive to someone who stays in the farm and gets his or her nails, you know, dirty and spends time with animals. There is a desire to preserve the authenticity of that experience. But beyond that, the question really is, where do we draw the line? If we see nature as a thing, as an object, then it becomes amenable to colonization. It becomes amenable to fascism. But if we see nature as process, then we see freedom being possible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For me, the bigger problem is our, I don't know, the distance between our living and the materials that we're using. And I think that's often what people are talking about when they talk about nature, is this idea that things are basic, you know, that natural things are basic. They're down to their bare building blocks and we can understand them as organic. Mm-hmm. And for me, the problem isn't our sense of disconnection from that. It's actually our sense of material complexity that's grown so great that we don't quite understand it anymore. Because as much as I love the links that my phone can make for me, what I don't love about it is that I can't repair it. And that it's drifted very far from my sense of reality, actually. It's become this sort of celestial object that if it dies, if the screen goes blank one day, there's nothing I can do about that. And I don't understand how it's composed or made or how it thinks.
Yes.
That's my technological naivety, though, I think.
Works for me as well. It's the same. But doesn't that also, I mean, it's like the things around us that we could readily describe as natural processes, if we delineate the world in that way. Like when things die, there's no fixing that, right? There's no...
I don't know
how plants work, right?
Not really, no.
They're just as inscrutable to me. I don't understand how Cordyceps unilateralis, the fungi, I don't know how it invades ants' bodies and converts them into zombie ants and performs this movie-like intelligence that leaves me astounded. So there is a sense of awe that is maybe a call to worship that is constantly held, not just with dying phones, but the emergence of all things.
And a life cycle that is expressed in our technology as much as it is in this natural world that we imagine, you know, this projected natural world that is just continuous with the rest of life as far as I can see it.
And that
brings us to questions of culture. And seeing as I've like mislabeled you as an anthropologist already, that's the concern of anthropologists.
A mislabeling that I wholeheartedly embrace, by the way.
but that's been on my mind a lot as people bring up nature to me all the time, that this kind of differentiation we have between nature and culture and the idea that humans have culture and everything else is either technology or nature. And, obviously, from what I've said, I already think that's a false distinction. But I begin to wonder about this idea that we've always had about humans holding culture, because I actually think as a white Westerner, I was raised academically to believe that I was culturally neutral, that almost I didn't have culture and that other societies had culture, you know, and... There's a sort of inflection of primitivism in there that like there are these more simple societies that have culture that we can observe, but ours is actually neutral and technocratic.
Yes.
How does that distinction work in this world now? Like, it's becoming absurd to even think that way, I think.
I mean, it plays out in the exact ways that feminists, materialists and ecologists and indigenous thinkers and black scholars have been naming for a long time that... The moment you start to think of nature as this thing apart and culture, then you are creating this anthropocentric division, this gash in the world, and a problem that you now try to solve or resolve by trying to re-entangle yourself. It's the Cartesian idea, right?
Yeah.
First, dualism. We separate ourselves, and then we wonder why we're separated and from the world. And then we now try to make moves to reconnect ourselves. But the prevailing and underpinning assumption is that we've never been apart with these dumb, mute and insignificant processes, that we're heading for the stars. And I think there's a resilient part of Western culture, that is this search for transcendence, like a Baudorian epic, a search for, a final singularity where we are shaved off and finally divorced from dust and materiality. And this longing is implicated in climate chaos, is implicated in the issues we're contending with today.
Sorry, I've got like a multitude of thoughts all springing up at once, but it strikes me that we want that Cartesian duality. You know, we want to be the separate mind and body.
Yeah.
But we want to integrate into the fabric of the universe from that standpoint rather than abandoning it first. So we want to stay separated and then backwardsly immersed rather than abandoning this idea of separation in the first place.
Mm-hmm. I think there is a morbid fear and disgust about entanglement, even though we speak poetically and glowingly about it, right? There's a sense in which we're frightened about the prospects of losing our independence. And sometimes I wonder, while chuckling, about the hidden microbes and the plant life and animal life and viral bacterial life and all the architectural instigations, textural instigations, you know, and the world around us that makes it possible to feel that fear.
Right? Yeah.
So that even our quest, our fear about losing our independence is already a mark of our interdependence with things, our interaction with things. So the thing here is that most of the time we're thinking of entanglement and enchantment as something to come. Right? It's futural. It's that one day we will unite with nature. And I think that's still enlightenment, beating around the bush, trashing around in the mud, not wanting to let go of the idea that it has always been, it has always been, you know, affiliated and relational and processual.
Well, we just no longer have the opportunity or the right to think that we're separate from the mud and the dirt. Like, you know, it's coming back to visit us. You know?
Yes. The mud is speaking, right? It's what Deleuze might call desire, right? It's that there's this vast, beautiful, I don't want to say beautiful, but I think of it poetically as beautiful. This more than human force that shapeshifts our bodies, right? Mm. You might even notice its shape when you find Will Smith speaking on The Daily Show with Trevor Noah, and his words are communicating one thing and his body is communicating loudly different stories. Different. It's how body language experts read the world. It's the idea that we are speaking with two tongues, right? There's what we say and there's what the world is saying with what we say.
Yeah, and how we're channeling that.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you about hushes, which you write about.
There we go.
Yeah, I feel like we're approaching hush territory. Can you try and articulate what hushes are? They're very poetic ideas, I think.
Well, I think the gig is up at this point, so I'll just let it slip or let it go. I've been playing this game with my readers for some time, especially people who interview me about hushes. And I'm mum about it. I'm very silent. I never say a word about it. I just say, what do you think? What do you think about hushes? People write me all the time and say, you know, I really try to find out the picture of a hush. You know, it's biological distinctions and all of that, but I really cannot locate it. Could you lead me to some references about it? And I chuckle, but I'll just, the gig is up. Maybe I'll just go ahead and say that.
You're going to have to fess up.
I'm just going to fess up that, you know, hushes are attempts, literary attempts to disturb our notions of completion. Right? It's the blind spot. They are peripheralities, if you will. They live at the corner of our eyes. And I went so much, you know, I took some trouble to actually describe how they live in the corners of our eyes. I'm trying to populate worlds beyond the visual regimes that we're used to. You know, to see straightforwardly is an energy of modern civilization. It's how we are trained to see, to deal with the problem, gain clarity about the problem. Clarity is the paradigm, you know, of choice. It's, well, beyond choice. It's more than volitional. Clarity and seeing straightforwardly. But I want to see how, or notice how there are worlds to the edges of straightforward thinking. I want to notice stupidity in a different way. I want to agentialize wisdom, you know, and to also bring in the idea that there's no sort of finality we can aspire to, a place where things are finally done. You know, I love the writer Ursula Le Guin and how she writes about the ones who walk away from Omelas, you know, disrupting finality in a sense, breaking utopia. Yeah. So the hushes are agents of disfinality. I just made that up. I'm sure that's okay with you.
You're a master phrase maker. I think they're the kind of dirty, seething seeds of the next life to come. You know, like they're these evasive, fugitive little notions that are shifting in your peripheral vision, but which are impossible to interrogate.
Impossible to interrogate, yes.
I adored that. My whole body spoke to that.
Indeed. It's the reason why I never find the final hush, right? It's the reason why the book ends with failure. It's the reason why the book ends with me dead, speaking from dust, right? The book was never meant to be a project of completion. It was meant to interrogate completion and to also honor things that spill away from, like you say beautifully, interrogation, textuality, clarity. It's the right to opacity, using Edward Glisson's phrasing.
We'll return to the episode in just a moment, but How We Live Now is part of a community, and I wanted to recommend another podcast that I think you'll love.
Hi, I'm Penny Winsor, author and book coach and host of Not Too Busy to Write, the podcast about writing amongst life's many other demands. Join me as I chat with fellow authors of all kinds about their work and, most importantly, how they get the work done. Writing can be a lonely pursuit, especially when you're juggling other work, parenting, caring, a disability. So join us each Wednesday to hear how other writers from backgrounds of all kinds make it work.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
It's very hard to assert that right to opacity, but also to assert the right to incompletion. And it's really interesting that you raised Ursula Le Guin, because I think she expresses that other notion of storytelling so well, that is in conflict with the hero's journey. That, you know, the fundamental problem of the hero's journey is it represents actually nothing to do with real life.
Yes.
And that there are these other ways of telling a story, and that is a foraging metaphor rather than a
carrier bag, right?
Rather than a kind of murderous killing and overcoming kind of metaphor.
Yes. Phallic spears and all that. Yes. Yes.
And to me, those stories are by nature unfinished and unfinishable. They're continuous.
Indeed. Beautiful. Here's my proposal, and I'm making it live to everyone here. How about we write something together, Catherine? Even if it's an essay or something, and we call it The Right to Incompletion. There is a sense in which modern civilization, and even if we're to think beyond those atmospheric concepts or localize it even further, cities, streets, social algorithms, you know, we are being trained to see from the perspective of completion. It might be implicated in how we think about morality, for instance, how we look back to the 60s and say, this person should have used this language or done this or behaved this way or stuff. It's that we assume that the world is just a chunk of moral bits and pieces that are readily available to any proper individual, you know? This idea of propriety and correctness and completion is, and this is not to say it's wrong either. I don't want to binarize the world. I don't traffic in binaries that way.
But to
notice what that is doing, how we are creating sediments of completion and how that might turn back and hurt us.
Yeah. I think as I age, I know this more intuitively than ever, that life is fundamentally
unstable. Like human life and human experience is fundamentally unstable. Yeah. And when I try and explain what childhood was like to my son and the expectations of us then and the very different human relationships that happened around that compared to how we parent now, it's inexpressible. And yet there was nothing wrong with it. It's just that we are a species in constant flux and we think we're stable, but we are... We change so, so much, and culturally we change enormously and we don't notice it happening.
Yes.
But we believe that we can trace it. And I don't think we can. It's much more random. It's sedimentary. It's like the floating up of sediment from the bottom of a stream and the swirls, you know, it's that random to me, I think, as I get older.
You know, it's that philosophical riddle of the ages in the ship of Theseus.
Ship of Theseus, yeah.
It's that we're constantly changing, but I think we memorialize or lionize selves as monoliths, you know, and so we think of ourselves as, you know, complete. It's how we even practice activism today. It's the creation of boogeymen and villains. And of course, I know probably the strategy of villainizing could be useful in some way. Who's to say?
You know,
it works. It definitely works for some ends. So this is not a way of saying, hey, by villainizing capitalism, for instance, or just creating isms, you are doing the wrong thing. You know, that would be to think within those, you know, architectural spaces. But it's to notice that it does certain things. You know, there is a cost to ontologizing the world in specific ways, to knowing the world in specific ways. And maybe we are at a point in our collective, and I use collective very sparingly and loosely, but maybe we're in a point at our collective planetary cautionary tale of existing and becoming together where we need to make new moves and take new directions and dance on the streets instead of just walking in rectilinear fashion, right? Maybe the public order is populated by cracks, and the work of our time is to stay within these cracks as spaces of inquiry. So,
this feels... Let the cracks open up. I think this is a good moment to talk about autism, actually, because you've written beautifully about your son's autism. I don't think you identify as autistic yourself, but am I wrong about that? I don't want to get that wrong.
Everyone else does.
Well, I wasn't going to say anything.
including psychologists, they're like, yes, you're autistic.
Oh, really? That's really interesting.
But I have no diagnosis to verify that. But
well, I
respect what people say I am.
That's interesting. Okay. I wanted to ask because I didn't want to kind of talk over your head on that front.
No problem.
Well, I have enormous problems with the culture around diagnosis anyway, but maybe this is not the moment. But I wanted to talk about your work in trying to understand your son's resistance to the world around him and how that opened up a space for you to think about kind of, I guess, resistant politics in lots of ways, that autism is actually, as I see it, and I think as you see it too, a fundamentally political, and wearing that label is actually a political statement of resistance for me now, increasingly.
That is a brilliant way to speak about autistic politics, right? That even feels tautological speaking with you, sister, right? Autism is fundamentally political is a beautiful way to notice that sometimes the world spills, right?
Yeah.
And I'm intrigued by excess, right? That by spillage, by...
Exuberance.
What the Aztecs called a sleeping excrescence, which is the name Huitlacoche, which is what they gave to the phenomenon of a fungal infection on corn.
I love
it, so poetic. And how they made this disease, what Americans would call corn smut, how they made that disease a delicacy, beautiful dish, right? Sleeping excrescence.
Beautiful.
Autism is like a sleeping excrescence to me. It's from one perspective, from the perspective of white modernity. And of course, by white, I don't mean white identified bodies. This is not reducible to individuals, you know, in the ways that popular activisms may reduce it. This is about terraforming projects. This is about the impersonal politics of whiteness and how it co-opts and enlists bodies to materialize itself, right? Mm-hmm. I feel that what white modernity, neurotypicality, is trying to do is to flatten the world. And in its efforts to flatten the world, to make it possible for the individual to thrive so that there are no confronting monsters, monsters or wilds,
yeah, right?
In trying to do so, it meets the ironic, it meets the paradoxical. And in trying to label something in a final way, that thing gains some kind of fugitive life and does something else. And you could almost tell the story of at least one genealogy of how we came to the idea of autism, you know, along with the rise of industrialization. Yeah. Right. The more we laid down the markers of civilization, it seemed intriguingly that at the same time, we started to measure more autism. Right.
Yeah.
Started to say more about autism. Maybe autism is the city resisting itself. Maybe that is the ecstasy of modernity exploring itself. Maybe that's quantum physics. Maybe that's spillage. Maybe that's blackness. Right. Mm-hmm. So when I speak about autism, I'm speaking about errancy, right? Or what some might say, errantry. I'm speaking about losing one's way. And I'm speaking about that as a politics, that we have congregated politics around baseline realities and stable natures for so long. Mm-hmm. So that all we do is try to enact inclusionary politics. That is a language of accommodation. Let's give you a place of power. Let's create more room for minorities to sit on this table of power. But what if there are other tables? What if there are other rooms? What if there are other ways of being in the world? And I think until we stray and learn to stray together and experiment with strain, we will continue to be trapped and incarcerated in a reality that no longer seems to work for most of us.
No, absolutely. And the more I speak and write about autism, the less I become interested in autism itself and the more I become interested in neurotypicality and what that means and what that is. Because both of them are fundamentally fugitive concepts, right?
Yeah.
And the more that we research autism, the less we understand what it is.
Yeah.
And it begins to seem to me that autism is the word that we use for deviation from the pattern and actually for resistance, you know, and one of the things that is common among autistic people and how we get that label in the first place is at some point we've resisted.
Yeah.
And for some people that resistance is met with, you know, with violence, honestly, and with incarceration.
Yes.
And for others of us, we grow up being seen as difficult or troubled or other or weird. Like weird is the word that chases us around forever. And that's exactly where I'd want to be. Like I can't imagine any other situation that I'd want to take up in this world other than different to that neurotypical mainstream. And yet we don't understand what neurotypicality is and what we mean by it and the fundamental values embedded in it. Again, it's seen as neutral and it is not neutral. It is something.
Yeah. Yes. Oh, beautiful. It's, you know, this has inspired a short story I'm currently writing, beginning to write. It's, I think I've called it Dr. Johnson's Asylum for the Sane. Something like that. But it definitely ends with the Asylum for the Sane. And it's a story of, well, I don't want to give it all away now, but it's basically...
No plot spoilers.
Fundamentally, the story of an inscrutable, mysterious rich man who starts up an asylum, but not for the people that you would think asylums are made for, but for the people who think they are not, you know, everyone else, the people who go to work on time, the people who are punctual, the people who know how to regulate their emotions, basically. And this strange man is basically looking at what I would, you know, what clinical psychologists might tag a meltdown, a tantrum with pediatric autism, right?
Yeah.
And say, don't you see that the air is enthused around this person, that they're feeling intensely? Don't you want to feel as well? When did you stop learning how to feel? When did you stop feeling? When did you stop playing? Right. And this is not to romanticize autism either as some fairy godlike status, but it is to call into question the forms we've taken and what we're missing out on is to put some buoyancy and credence and value to the rumors that there are other ways of being alive.
Absolutely. And what you're saying makes me think immediately of my perception as a child, which was that other people were numb and I was feeling. Like, because I'd watch other people move through public spaces and I'd be flinching at every loud sound or shrinking away when people banged into me. And you know, normally itching away at a seam or a label in my t-shirt.
Yeah.
And other people would walk across that same space with no seeming affect at all. Mm-hmm. They were not confronted by it. And it's only later in life when I realized that the label autistic fitted me, that I realized that people thought that I had no affect, that my affect was wrong, that my emotions weren't working at all.
Yeah.
And I'd always assume that about them. I could never understand why people were not feeling this incredibly kind of assailing universe around them that was assailing me.
It's right there in the name, right? Autism, it's self. It's like you're so stuck on yourself that you don't feel.
And yes,
you're
not- I know. Yeah. It's quite that term autism, we've all rushed to adopt it because it's been a clarion call, you know, and we wanted to gather under that umbrella. But I am troubled by the way that label was created, which came from this idea of self-absorption and self-obsession.
How about we experiment with one now, sister? Experiment with a new name now. How about now?
I know you can do this because you create the most amazing strings of words spontaneously. So I feel like it's like jazz, like you could just improvise 100 of those in the next 10 minutes. It's going to be beautiful.
Rhizoism or something. It has to be something that basically says there isn't a stable self that the supposed autistic is stuck on. Instead, they're feeling intensely, seeing intensely, right?
There's something, and we're skirting Deligny here, who we're both a fan of, who worked with autistic young people and essentially set them loose on a mountainside in France to just be, to exist. But he talked about the idea of the Arachnean, which is this imaginary society, culture, world that you might compare to a kind of Atlantis in which we are fully alive to our interconnection, but to the way that this interconnection is really fragile and kind of improvised in the moment and fleeting, but profound and beautiful. And I would love the word for autism to express that, because I don't think we're separate. I don't think that we are isolated anyway. I think we actually feel those roots of connection very, very profoundly, but they're often outside of language.
Well, it'll have to, you know, I'm thinking about my son, and the meaning of his name is never far off. He's always beside. And I'm thinking about autism as this sidling intelligence. You know, one which also inspired by Deligny, you know, I have written in my notes as the Paraterranean, right? Almost very similar to the Arachnean, is a form of subterranean life, but not subterranean in the ways that might invite you to abseil, you know, down a crack or something. But the subterranean in the sense of a Paraterranean, to the side of, that invites you to walk on your toes to see it, to bend your posture, to feel it, that they're between bodies. You know, the Harry Potter-esque notion of running into the wall at the train station.
Yes, yeah.
You know, that almost feels autistic. It's like everyone's walking this path and you go the wrong way, right? There's something about autism that feels like taking the wrong path, adopting a different posture, feeling intensely. As a result.
There's we'll something very yeah, we will. And I think the metaphors that always come to mind for me, although apparently I'm not able to create metaphor because I'm autistic, but there we go. It's interesting. I find autistic people like very symbolic thinkers. But it's a mycelium and this kind of this fine threaded network that weaves its way between multiple actors in the woodland, and which is vast, like unfathomably vast and unfathomably ancient, but it's also fundamentally interstitial. It never wants to be the main picture. It's too evasive for that. And that makes so much sense to me.
Maybe, of course, we've already touched on this, that autism in this, I don't want to say in itself, you know, as if it has a stable meaning of its own, but we're describing something that is fugitive, that is that will not be named finally. But there is some value to strain away from the idea of a narcissistic self that can only behold itself, right? Which is the designation, autism.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And I'm really leaning into mycelialism now, or mycelism now, or 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 fugitivism, or something. Something that says that there's a different posture here, and it's not pathological, it's political.
It's fundamentally political. And I suppose to kind of close a huge arc that we've been talking in, when I first read about hushes in your book, I wrote autism in the the margin. Hushism, yeah.
We are
the hushes.
Wow, that feels right.
I think that's a moment to close our conversation, because I would love to continue it many, many times, and maybe we can. But that's a really beautiful place to land now.
I think so.
Thank you. That feels like my brain has been set on fire in 100 different places all at once.
Me too. Thank you. It's been great.
Ah, the water is so warm. It's so funny, the last time I went in, it was freezing. I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Bio. I was thinking about him as I was swimming, and thinking about how I like to swim, which is in a very non-linear way. I like to go in and see where the sea takes me, to bob about like a cork, to stretch my limbs, to abandon this idea of taking control and cutting through the sea. I always want to be part of the sea for a little while and to listen for what the sea tells me. I think this morning it said, welcome home. I'm now full of wild ideas that I'll do the double and swim again this evening. You never know, might do. It's a big day. Thanks for listening, everyone, and coming along with me this morning. You helped to get me there. I'll see you very soon.
And that's all for this episode. Thanks for being here to explore how we live now. This podcast is presented by Catherine May, produced by Megan Hutchins and Buddy Peace, with social media by Sarah Horner and communications by Becca Pierce. Buddy Peace also composed the wonderful incidental music. For updates, show notes, transcriptions and plenty of stories, subscribe to my newsletter at catherinemay.substack.com, where you can also upgrade to support the show and join my vibrant community of readers, writers, and wanderers. And finally, if you enjoyed my podcast, please consider buying my new book, Enchantment. There's a link in the show notes. See you next time.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.